Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Tonight we are discussing San Francisco's November ballot, an overwhelming document which includes 25 local measures, many of which are generated by our elected representatives. In a little over a month, residents will be voting on hot topics such as education, affordable housing, homelessness, and public transportation, if they happen to make it to the end of the ballot. San Franciscans are no strangers to an excessive number of propositions. In 1993, voters addressed a record 28 local measures. However, critics claim that many of the current initiatives have more to do with politics than substance, and our elected officials are not doing their jobs. Proponents of direct democracy maintain that it is necessary to protect citizens from government corruption and powerful special interest groups. So tonight we will ask, is direct democracy in San Francisco broken? What are the consequences of citizen-driven legislation on the city of San Francisco, its budget, elected representatives, and voters? What can be done to reform the system? And do we, the voters, actually want reform? Joining me in the studio is Joe Eskenazi, a senior editor at San Francisco Magazine and author of the recent articles, San Francisco Votes on More Stuff Than Anyone, It's a Disaster, and We Love It and Won't Stop, and The Gangs of City Hall. Joe was formerly a staff writer and columnist for SF Weekly. He was born in San Francisco, raised in the Bay Area, and attended UC Berkeley. Welcome, Joe.
I never left.
Great. And we also have Judge Quentin Kopp, who has had an illustrious career in both San Francisco City and California State law and politics. Judge Kopp was elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 1971 and was reelected four times. In 1986, he was elected to the California State Senate, a role he served for 12 years. After his time in the State Senate, Judge Kopp served as general criminal and civil trial judge in San Mateo County for more than a decade. He was educated at Dartmouth College and earned his law degree at Harvard, and he's currently a member of the San Francisco Ethics Commission, and I'd also have to add that he's very likely City Vision's first guest with an interstate named after him. Welcome, Judge Kopp. And joining me by phone is Dr. Bruce Kane, who is a professor of political science at Stanford University with an appointment at the Bill Lane Center for the American West. Prior to working at Stanford, Dr. Kane taught at both Caltech and UC Berkeley, where he was a director of the Institute of Governmental Studies and the executive director of the UC Washington Center. He's also a prolific author, and his most recent publications includes the book Democracy, More or Less, America's Political Reform Quandary, and many scholarly articles. Dr. Kane was educated at Bowdoin College, Oxford University, where he was a Rhodes Scholar, and Harvard University, where he earned his PhD. Welcome, Dr. Kane.
Good evening.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Well, let's find out a little bit about the background and history of direct democracy and local initiatives, both in San Francisco and in California. And Dr. Kane, I wanted to start with you by phone. What is the origin of direct democracy in the United States? What system are we modeled after here?
Well, the closest would be Switzerland, but it emerged essentially, actually started in Los Angeles, but it emerged in the progressive slash populist era of early 20th century, and it spread from largely, Western and Midwestern states. There are some states in the East that have it, but predominantly it's a phenomena of Western and Midwestern states. And it basically has two impetuses. The populist impetus is really behind the initiative, where the people get to propose an idea and put it on the ballot. And the progressive side of this is more sort of the referendum or the recall, where you get to check representative government. What we know is that across the country, there's a wide variation in how easy it is to use direct democracy. It can be regulated by the number of signatures that are required, the amount of time that it takes to circulate, the level of professionalism in terms of the consulting industry, all these things, limitations on subject matter. Many states have much more limitations. And so the bottom line is that of all the states, California has the most user-friendly form of direct democracy, and it has the most advanced industry in terms of people that can run everything from circulating a an initiative measure, getting the signatures to actually writing the thing, et cetera. So running the campaign. So it's a very professionalized operation here in California. The rules are relatively easy. It's easy to get into the game as compared to other states.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Kane, can you just give us a brief description of the balance between direct and representative democracy, both in California at the state level and at the local level?
Well, you know, the balance. Some states have an indirect initiative and don't allow a direct initiative. So, of all the different measures—the recall, the referendum, and the initiative—the initiative is by far the most radical because it basically bypasses representative government. It bypasses the checks and balances, except for the court, which can come in and negate parts that are unconstitutional or unlawful. So, it by far. The one that replaces representative government in the most radical way is the initiative, which allows citizens to put a proposal on the ballot and then to vote on it. The referendum or bond measures that are initiated by the legislature is a little less radical. Often they require supermajority votes to get them out of the legislative body. And, you know, in many cases, they're put there by elected officials because they don't want to make a choice or they can't make a choice or because some group is lost at the council or the county or the legislative level and they want a second bite at the apple.
Well, this is actually a question I wanted to ask you since you study this issue. What do local ballot initiatives tend to be typically used for?
Well, of course, one big one is anything having to do with taxes or spending. So a lot of times if there's a controversial measure that might cost some money, the elected officials might put it on the ballot for that reason. Or if you're going for a bond measure but you're required by law and to put it on the ballot. So I think budgetary matters are often there. Sometimes there are symbolic issues. There's one in the statewide ballot, I believe, on Citizen United or disapproval. So sometimes they're used to sort of make a statement, and that happens at the local government level, mm-hmm. too. Basically, a lot of things that normally we would think of as sort of statutory measures that we would expect representative bodies to deal with, have increasingly been handed over to the initiative process. So if you think of the initiative processes legislative referred measures, if you think of those as they should be reserved for special occasions or for big issues, that's not what happens. Often it's, and increasingly, there are, things that normally you would expect a legislature or a city council or a county board to handle, but for whatever reason, they're put on the ballot to let the voters decide.
Well, I think we've got some good examples of that here in San Francisco that I know we're definitely going to want to get to. But I want to go to Judge Quentin Kopp. You've served in San Francisco city government, and I think you've got, if not the best historical perspective on this. So historically speaking in the city of San Francisco, what have been the most popular topics for local ballot measures in the city?
Generically, the answer is usually something you couldn't get 6 votes to pass. And I was the most prolific user of the initiative in that respect between 1972 and 1986, and always successful. I lost one, but I came back with that same one 2 years later. And it passed. But San Francisco has a unique provision in the charter historically since the 1932 charter revision, which also allows not 6 supervisors, but 4 supervisors to submit an initiative to voters without the assent of the mayor, much less a majority of the members of the Board of Supervisors. And in general, supervisors will use that four or more provision or individually lead the effort to collect enough voters' signatures for a political reason, or you want to say a political policy or public policy.
So were there any particular topics that that seemed to need that that four votes to get to the ballot?
Yeah, something that you can't get six votes for. Mm-hmm. And you go to the voters.
If you feel that you can't get the votes among your colleagues, but you are on the right side of the voters, it's not unusual for this to happen. It's not unusual for this to happen, and this year's board in San Francisco is almost tailor-made to have too many issues on the ballot. First of all, it's a desirable ballot because of the high turnout, but without wading too far into Arcana here, this is a majority progressive board, but it has a moderate president and a moderate majority on all of the committees. So since there are two moderates and one progressive on all of the committees, a lot of things get bottled up. And therefore, the progressives are inclined to kick it to the main, to the board, and then get those four votes and put it before the voters, rather than have it get bottled up in committee and never get out at all.
Mm-hmm. So, Joe Eskenazi, what are you seeing then as common themes in the ballot then this year? To Judge Kopp's point that the supervisors are kind of punting to the ballot on these issues that they can't get the majority for.
Well, one thing that we're not seeing is dueling ballot measures in San Francisco. They are on the state level. They have dueling plastic bag ballot measures and things like that. In San Francisco, you don't have dueling ballot measures where one will – actually, you kind of do. Actually,
you do with the housing.
Yes, you do. That's okay, so that negates my point so much. You don't have as many as we might have. What are we having? There are set-asides for street trees. There are set-asides for seniors and the disabled. There are set-asides for affordable housing. We are going to be asked to vote on a soda tax. We're going to be asked to raise the sales tax writ large to benefit transportation and the homeless, which is a bit perverse because it's odd to have a regressive tax to benefit the poorest people. Those kinds of things. Also, the four measures that have come under fire from the mayor's camp, those are things that the progressives certainly could not. They possibly could. They got six votes on those, in fact. Mm-hmm. That's something that you would think. They certainly couldn't get eight votes. They couldn't get that over the mayor to limit his own power.
So we know that elected officials are putting some of these on the ballot. What about interest groups? Judge Kopp, in your time, did you see outside groups trying to get initiatives on the ballot? And if so, were there any particular groups that tended to be active?
Not very many. I can't remember offhand any interest group, unlike today. Mm-hmm. Today, I think you do have interest groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Joe Eskenazi, are there some interest groups behind some of these ballot initiatives that you can talk about?
Yeah. One of the things here is that the thesis of this show is direct democracy broken in San Francisco, not necessarily because 21 of the 25 measures that we'll be voting on were generated by our lawmakers. Two of them are coming from the realtors. One of them is coming from a developer that wants to carve out exceptions to city rules. And what is the fourth? There is a fourth one that is coming from the people. That one has escaped me at the moment. But certainly I can think in the recent past you've had the police officers union, his signature gathered in order to get pension measures before the voters. That's the kind of thing that you'd have signature gatherers going around and doing.
Yeah, let's talk about the signature gather initiative. That's another way that they can get on the ballot. Judge Kopp, do you know what the process is for that to happen? And can you give us examples of citizens, prompted initiatives?
Well, sure. I'm going to have to personalize it. I had a pretty faithful core of supporters who were voters. And usually the idea would come from me, or it would come from one of my associates who was like-minded. And you put out a letter to 1,000 people, or if you were lucky to have 1,000, and you get people in to carry petitions. And I used to be proud of the fact that I never had to qualify an initiative by paying signature gatherers. You couldn't do that now. today.
You couldn't and you can't, in fact. I'm doing the research for the story in San Francisco Magazine, and the book was old, but I'm pretty confident that this is still accurate. It noted that a 1980s-era state ballot measure on hunting bobcats or something like that was the last ever petition measure that didn't use paid gatherers. So it's something that you just – everybody has to do that now. And it's actually – there's a great article to be written on the nuances of a signature gatherer if you're carrying six petitions.
And I'm sure Professor Kang can expand this, but the cost of these paid signature gatherers is phenomenal to me. They're getting – up to $7 a signature, if you can imagine.
That's the one they put on the top of the pile.
Well, let's go to Professor Kane on that. Professor Kane, certainly at the state level, we know there's plenty of paid signature gatherers. Can you talk about that and maybe what restrictions there might be at the local level for some of these citizen signed initiatives?
Yeah, I mean, there was an attempt at least a decade or so ago to try to ban paid signature gatherers. And the court basically struck it down as a restriction on freedom of association. So you're limited to do, and just as you can't really control the amount of money, which is the other aspect of it, the reason you have paid signature gatherers that get that much money is that the industry, you know, has generated, you know, very expensive. They raise a lot of money. There aren't contribution limits on initiative measures, and so you can get a couple interest groups or major donors that want to support a particular measure, and so you have you're not forced, as a candidate is, to go out and get a lot of contributions by doing lots of dinners and things. You can get a lot of money, and you know, the signature, pretty much the industry can guarantee that if you have enough money, they can get almost anything qualified for you. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that they're going to ultimately pass. I don't know the statistics at San Francisco, but at the state level, most of the ones that circulate don't actually make it onto the ballot, and most of the ones that make it onto the ballot don't ultimately pass, more than go down than succeed. So it is, you know, it's not a certain thing that just because you've got money, you can get your idea on the ballot and it'll actually pass, but it certainly, as Joe points out, at this point, the whole notion, the romantic notion of volunteer people going out there and getting the signature is just not the common way in big cities or in the state as a whole that we're seeing these measures get qualified.
Well, the initiative in California, over 100 years old, was designed for citizens, which raises the question, in listening to Professor Kane, I wonder if it's constitutional to enact a statute or even a local ordinance putting a limit on how much you can pay a signature gatherer.
Well, that's
probably isn't. But it ought to be examined.
Well, that's I wanted to talk reform proposals at the end, but this sounds like a good time to ask this question. And Professor Kane, is there a way to regulate that citizen signature gathering process?
Well, you know, as I said, the court's been kind of skeptical of that. I mean, you could try various things. You know, you could try to make sure the signature gatherers are from the community in some way by incentivizing it. But the court, this particular court, has been very skeptical of campaign finance or any kind of schemes that favor challengers over incumbents or favor, and try to give one side or the other a benefit to the law. So I'm not sure whether it would survive. A lot will depend upon what the court looks like going forward on these matters. If it stays with the current court, they're very skeptical of any kind of limitation on the amount of money that is spent on speech. The only reason they're going to accept any kind of regulation is if you can make a strong argument that it prevents corruption. But if your argument is simply that you want to keep rich, wealthy interests from putting measures on the ballot, my guess is that the current Supreme Court won't go for that. They're only looking at justifications that are very narrowly related to quid pro quo corruption. And, so far, most reform attempts haven't been able to get sort of arguments about limitations on spending past a court, the Supreme Court.
So tough road to go in terms of reform on citizen signature gathering. Joe Eskenazi, do you want to weigh in on this issue?
Well, if you were going to actually try and do something about that, rather than limiting the citizen signature gatherers, you would change the threshold of signatures needed, which is completely arbitrary county to county in San Francisco. Sorry, in California, San Francisco has a relatively low threshold, whereas in Oakland, you have to get just about as many signatures to get something on the ballot, even though San Francisco's twice as big a city. And if you go from county to county, you know, is it the number of votes cast and you need a percentage of that, or is it the number of registered voters? It's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And what percentage do you need? In some counties, it's 25, 30, 40%. In San Francisco, it's 10. So that's if you were trying to limit people's input, that would be the way to do it.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we are discussing San Francisco's 25 local ballot measures with Bruce Kane, professor of political science at Stanford University, Joe Eskenazi, senior editor at San Francisco Magazine, and Judge Quentin Cox, member of the San Francisco Ethics Commission, retired California Superior Court judge, former San Francisco supervisor, and prior California State Senator. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you, the voter, want reform? If so, what would you like to see done? Do you believe that local direct democracy is a predominantly good thing for San Francisco? If so, why? And if not, why not? And how are you educating yourself on next month's ballot measures? The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on kalw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Joe Eskenazi, I wanted to go back to you and talk about this phone book-sized ballot measures that the San Francisco voters have to face this November. What are the factors that are contributing to this particularly long ballot this year?
Well, one of them is, as we mentioned before, progressive supervisors being incentivized to go to the voters because otherwise their material will get caught in committee. And there's also it's an election year. People are running against one another, so they're not inclined to compromise. So it's, well, you know, let's see what the voters want to do. We are asking, there's also a lot of just housekeeping measures in order for bonding purposes or for any kind of tax, you have to go to the voters. And we are also asking for a lot of set-asides on feel-good things, like mentioned seniors, the disabled, trees of all things, which became incredibly contentious. So there's that. And then there's also, the contentious tents measure. There are a few other measures like the
homeless tents.
The homeless tents measure. There is one in which, the supervisors are essentially more or less mandating certain police officers be doing certain things. So there's always, you know, politicking that way as well.
And we're getting an email from Francis on this point, mm-hmm. with Joe's point here. Why are we voting on all this stuff? Don't we vote in our board members so they can legislate? Why are they sending so many issues for us to decide? It's a terrible way to run the city. Judge Kopp, what's your response to that? I mean, as a supervisor, you took advantage of this.
I've got to be careful because one of the bars of the charter for ethics commission members is taking sides or participating in any ballot measure, pro or con, or any candidate election, pro or con for a candidate. San Francisco, in my experience over 55 years, has had a healthy appetite for initiatives. California has the healthiest appetite in the country. In California, I think San Francisco has the healthiest because of that 1932 charter provision enabling it only four supervisors to put something on.
Or the mayor just by himself.
Huh?
Or the mayor just by himself.
Yeah, or the mayor by himself, mm-hmm. instead of schlepping around in front of the supermarkets collecting signatures. And again, it depends on the makeup of the board. I think Joe referred earlier to the fact the record is 27.
28.
On the 28?
Yeah.
All right, and so there are 25 this year. To me, now, playing political science, like Professor Kane. It's a reflection of the division on the board, which Joe has been discussing, so-called progressive, so-called moderates. And I think also, here I show my bias, it's a reflection of electing supervisors by district. Because districts are not the same in population makeup, composition of voters, and the rest, and that would seem to me to lead to different emphasis on different issues.
So district as opposed to at-large elections for supervisors.
Yeah. We never had, more than six or seven initiatives on the ballot, even with that four-supervisor provision. Mm-hmm. I used it only once, and that was on taxicab permits about 1976 or 77.
So we got a caller coming in, Dave from San Francisco. Dave, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yep, we got you.
Okay, well, I'm going to follow immediately on what Senator Kopp just remarked. The taxicab initiative that he put together worked remarkably well. Okay, so I'll just say that as praise to this man. And I enjoy the show. I like your hosting. And I've heard these three guests talk, and most of them I'm really okay with. And now, what do I do? Here I live in San Francisco. I got two ballots. I got a whole long local ballot, and then I have a whole long state ballot. And now I'm going to have to make a big chart on my wall. And it's just, why do I have to be such a scholar in order to vote for things?
So, yeah, you're cry of frustration.
I'll take it on the air.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for the call. So, cry of frustration. We're hearing this from a lot of residents. Well, let me bring Professor Kane back in on this one. Professor Kane, do you hear a lot of this? I mean, given your line of research, you must hear a lot of people complain to you. What's generally your advice to folks who are struggling through these long ballots?
Well, at Berkeley, we used to have a sort of a ballot party where everybody took one ballot and took the responsibility for, reading it all over and summarizing it. But, that's just not a realistic expectation for busy people that have real lives. And I do think it's a problem. The state congestion is caused by the fact that the state in, I think, 2011 or so, decided that they would not allow measures on the June ballot because of the turnout was often so low. So the consequence of that is that we now have like 17 measures on the state ballot. And I just think the caller is exactly right. I mean, I'm a political scientist. I'm looking at a 223-page voter pamphlet for the state, and I haven't even gotten the one for Santa Clara, or maybe I got it at the bottom of a pile, but I'm a political scientist, and I'm not going to be able to read all those, the laws and go through it. So I think, at some point, people have to decide whether to put a limit on the number of measures that are on a ballot. Just like, you can't have too much traffic. You have to be able to regulate it. But that's a decision that has to be made by the voters of San Francisco. If they're happy with what they get and they're happy with it, then there's not much you can do. You're just gonna have to bite the bullet. And what we know from research is that most people do not read these measures in great detail. Most people are either going to look at some direct mail that gives them some recommendations, or they're going to follow the lead of people that they trust.
And Joe Eskenazi has actually written on this. So, Joe, let me pass this one to you. What do you tell folks when they complain about the long ballot?
Well, I think people who are going to vote at the ballot, going to vote in a garage or in a church or whatever, it's very unfortunate. It takes a good 20 or 30 minutes to get through this, and it took me 20 or 30 minutes to get through, and I knew most of the measures pretty well. I predict very long lines and a lot of consternation. Voting now is like doing your taxes. It helps to do it at home, where you can look at all your materials and whatnot and spread them out in front of you. The gentleman who called in said he was going to make a chart on the wall. Not a bad idea. Not a bad idea. I say there are parts of the country where there is a limitation as to how much can get onto the ballot at one time. That's certainly something to think about. There are, myriad legal situations that, you know, with regards to that. I think that another thing that's worth mentioning, Professor Kane does hit the nail on the head, because we are no longer having citizen initiatives on the June ballots. It does load up November. I have to think it's almost kind of an implicit admission that that it's an unhealthy system when you don't want people voting on these potentially very consequential matters during low turnout elections, as occurred in 1978 with Prop 13.
Well, make clear that that rule only applies to state ballots.
Exactly, exactly.
City has them both June and November.
Yes,
so
exactly.
We get this long homework assignment in June, and we've now procrastinated and pushed it to November, and the homework assignment is coming due in a major way. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing San Francisco's 25 local ballot measures, with Bruce Kane, professor at Stanford University, Joe Eskenazi with San Francisco Magazine, and Judge Quentin Kopp, member of the San Francisco Ethics Commission, retired California Superior Court judge, and former San Francisco supervisor and California state senator. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment on kalw.org or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have another Dave from San Francisco. This is David. So, David, welcome to City Visions.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yeah, I just wanted to weigh in about all these ballot measures. I'd like to say I'm happy that we have so many ballot measures, and I'm happy that we may be one of the most democratic cities, if not the most democratic city in the country. You know, somebody's got to try it. And I don't think that, you know, if you brought up Socrates and you showed him all the governments of the world that say they're democracies, I don't think he would think that. I don't think you can say that any of them really, really is a democracy. And so somebody's got to try it, and I think it should be us. And I spent the summer, I'm an independent filmmaker, I went to the Republican convention and the Democratic convention and filmed the protests, and one thing I heard from everybody is they want a more democratic system. Hmm. And, you know, it's messy, it's ugly, it doesn't always look like you want it to, but, I mean, I think it's a project worth pursuing, and if we're the one place in the country that can do it, then I think we should.
All right. Well, it's good to hear that perspective. Certainly, you know, we hear people complaining, but it's nice to hear the pro perspective. Judge Kopp, what's your take on
I was thinking of the trivia question. Where was the initiative process founded? Professor might know. I'm going to guess Australia. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's been around so long, and it's been part of San Francisco for 75 years plus. I could think of starting, if your purpose was to reduce the number, with amending the charter to stop just four supervisors from putting something on the ballot. In fact, you might stop the supervisors, period, from putting something on the ballot. Although, of course, they need to do it with general obligation bonds or an increase in taxes like this proposed sales tax increase. Now, if that's your goal, that's a place to start. And those debates would be bloody in mm-hmm. committee, because what supervisor is going to give up his or her ability to get just three others sign the sheet on the initiative, and then it goes to the ballot, and to heck with you other seven people.
Having that...
Yeah, so Joe Eskenazi, want to hear...
Yeah, having that tool is very valuable for a legislator, because you can kind of strap a brick to the accelerator using the ballot initiative as the brick. You know, you can introduce an ordinance, and you can introduce an identical ballot measure, word for word identical, and you can say, we can negotiate on this ordinance, or I'm going to introduce this ballot measure as it is now. And then you can get concessions that way. And that has happened. You know, that happened this year in a duel between supervisors Mark Farrell and Aaron Peskin. with regard to in-law units, and we would have had a 26th initiative if they had not come to a consensus.
So we've been a little bit closer to setting the all-time record.
Yeah. And also keep in mind, as I believe Professor Kane said, there is no limit on the contributions to a ballot committee, whereas if I am running and when Supervisor Kopp was running, you can only donate to him in increments of 500 it is now. Whereas if I am running concurrently with a ballot measure that's identified with me, people can dump a lot of money into that.
And that was a tactic that I thought of a couple times, that it would give me more publicity if I was fronting a ballot initiative, which got on the ballot the hard way with the requisite number of voter signatures.
So let's go back to the phone lines. We have Ruth Ann from El Cerrito. Ruth Ann, welcome back to City Visions.
Thank you very much. I have what I think is an unpopular position. I don't endorse the ballot initiative process at all. I really believe that we have people in the legislature that are supposed to be making laws. And it's not that they're not making laws, but that the legislature is supposed to have committees that will vet the different propositions and research it and do all the work to flesh out all the details, and then come back to the various legislatures who can decide on what to do with the position one way or another. I know that lots of citizens have various opinions, but I think voting and having opinions is different from making laws.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you calling in with that perspective. I think a lot of people share it. In fact, it reminds me of...
It's not so unpopular. Thank you.
it reminds me of the San Francisco Chronicle, which I think somewhat for reasons you're describing has recommended a no vote on a number of the propositions. And Joe Eskenazi, can you talk a little bit about the Chronicle's position, if you're familiar with them? Basically saying that, you know, that the legislature, in this case, the Board of Supervisors ought to be doing their job. This isn't something that needs to be pushed to the voters.
There are a lot of positions like that, and certainly a lot of the ballot, less so with the professionally written ones, but anything coming from the body politic, there's a good chance that it's not written as well, and there's a good chance there are unintended consequences, and there's a good chance that it's going to spur a concatenation of lawsuits that'll keep it from being enacted for quite some time. Mm-hmm. Especially with a ballot this long, people talk about ballot fatigue. I don't know if it's real or not, but certainly, you know, it's conceivable.
Well, unintended consequences, that's an interesting subject. Judge Cobb, can you recall an instance where something made it to the ballot, passed, and then ended up with some unintended consequence that no one foresee and created problems down the road?
No, I can't. You should have told me. I would have studied.
We'll have you back on.
I can't. I know of ballot measures by the initiative process which were challenged judicially and found either unconstitutional or flawed legally in some other way, and that's common. In fact, Professor Kane participated in such a process with a state ballot measure. I was one of three instigators of trying to control campaign contributions and the use of contributions to feed other candidates for office. So, and that is a common complaint that the initiators of the initiative are amateurs, they're not professional, they don't get good legal advice, etc. I think that's a flawed argument because over my legal career, I've observed more and more lawyers who specialize in election law. And they are available at $500 to $1,000 an hour, I'm sure.
Read it over for you for just a couple hours. Yeah, that's,
well, yeah. I find it reassuring that you can't recall any unintended consequences, at least in recent memory.
Statewide, I think Prop 13 is the big example.
That was going to be my question for Professor Kane. Certainly at the statewide level, there must be some examples of unintended consequences. Can you speak to any that you can recall?
I think the best example is Prop 13.
It looks like you're just breaking up there, Professor Kane. Oh, I don't.
What? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you. There you go.
I was saying, I think there. I agree with Joe. The Prop 13 is the best example because it had a monumental effect on many different aspects of how we collect taxes in this state and really diminish the property tax component and moved us increasingly to personal income tax, for example, or using more bonded indebtedness. It changed the relationship between local and state taxes we didn't foresee.
Yeah, no, you're breaking up a little bit still there, but Prop 13 definitely seems like a classic example here. Joe Eskenazi,
one
your
of
thoughts?
The local ones I could talk to you about.
You're
is...
You're going to let me defend Proposition 13.
Locally, I can tell you that certainly I remember reading through a decade ago ballot guides in which the city controller did not anticipate that we would ever have pension problems in San Francisco, and therefore it was okay to up the retirement benefits to police officers to 90% at age 55. And thanks to the ballot initiative process, we also incentivized police officers to stay 3 years past their retirement, and they could essentially get pensions and salaries at the same time, thereby incentivizing them to both retire early and work late. And in the end, this ended up costing the city somewhere between, you know, $55 and $75 million and also, you know, had whatever effect it did on the hiring process. And this was also due, you know, no one anticipated the 2008 recession, which did put quite a big hole in the pension fund.
So things can go awry. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing San Francisco's 25 local ballot measures with Bruce Kane from Stanford University, Joe Eskenazi from San Francisco Magazine, and Judge Quentin Kopp. We definitely invite you to call in with questions or comments. The number to call to join that conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on kalw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have Starchild from San Francisco. Starchild, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thank you. I agree with the previous caller, Dave, and also Judge Kopp. It's not that there's too many measures on the ballot, but there's too many measures put on by politicians. I don't think they should be allowed to put measures on the ballot at all unless they go through the same process as the rest of us. I mean, they can go out and collect signatures. You know, we've got right now, you know, politicians who are in the city, as of 2010, according to the Chronicle, one out of every three city government employees is making over $100,000 a year, and you know, they have plenty of resources to you know, get that done if they want to do that. By the way, it also costs $5,000 just to get on the ballot to run for mayor. I'm very afraid that we're disenfranchising ordinary people, and the backlash as a result of all these politician-sponsored measures on the ballot is people are going to be frustrated. They're going to be, why are we getting all these things on the ballot? Let's limit how much stuff is on the ballot. Mm-hmm. But then you end up limiting the citizen's voice and just putting it more in the hands of the politicians. And the bottom line is, you know, there wouldn't be so much stuff on the ballot if government wasn't so huge and complex and out of control.
So that's an interesting question. Yeah. It goes back to Judge Kopp's earlier point around citizen signature gathering. Judge Kopp, do you have a response to Starchild on that question?
I think I'd reiterate what I said previously. If you were starting to revise the system, you'd start in San Francisco with allowing just four supervisors to put something on the ballot. I don't want to stray from my prohibitions as an ethics commissioner to suggest that you could, I suppose, write a law, certainly at the state level, which prohibited the legislature from doing so. As was pointed out earlier, it isn't just 25 ballot measures in San Francisco. You got 17 from the state. And I've forgotten how many.
Unilaterally.
Huh?
The mayor can put one on just by himself.
Yes, Joe Eskenazi reminded us of that fact, and I have seen mayors do that. Joe Alioto did it a couple of times.
There's also the dark money in politics of the people in government using our money, our tax money, to lobby us via public relations. All the people in government who have public relations titles, communications people, this sort of thing. I mean, they're basically using our own money to try to persuade us that they're doing a good job. I say just do your job and let we the people decide if you're doing a good job or not. All public relations spending.
Well, that's the strong argument. On the other hand, the caller has said
it's how it's
he's
done in
happy to make decisions that are represented by initiatives.
So let's go to this issue of reform. You know, we've heard some different perspectives, pro con on direct democracy and the ballot here. I'd like to talk to Professor Kane, if he's still with us by phone, to hear what are some of the sort of typical reform proposals that get tossed out there when it comes to trying to rein in the direct democracy system. Professor, I think we've lost Professor Kane, unfortunately. So let me turn that question over to you, Joe Eskenazi. Have you seen reform proposals, maybe if not statewide here in San Francisco, that could potentially have an impact on limiting the ballot?
Well, I mean, if the operative word is potentially have an impact, then no, because the fact of the matter is while there have been a series of really good studies by the Public Policy Institute of California on this, and while people complain about how much there is on the ballot, and people certainly complain even more about how confusingly written it is, often intentionally, they want to have the option. So I believe that you're dealing with 70%+ of people who like this, and that's a hard hill to climb if 70% of the people want this, despite acknowledging the limitations of it. And you know, here in San Francisco, the PPIC, which again has done very good work on this, found that we are circulating far more initiatives than anyone else in all of California. I think it was between 1990 and 2000, we circulated 54 of them, and no other city had more than 15. So, I mean, this is something specifically if you're going to address it in this city, in this state, it would be very difficult, very difficult.
And I think Professor Kane is now back with us. So Professor Kane wanted to ask you about reform proposals that get tossed about for direct democracy.
I thought the earlier suggestion that maybe the limit should be put on the number of measures that are put on by the board itself, because it doesn't sound like there are that many that come out through the actual citizen initiative process. So maybe that's one way to go without asking this question of how many is too many. I mean, I will say that I've over the last 30 years gone to dozens of discussions about reforming the initiative process, and when we had the Constitutional Revision Commission in the early 90s, there were a lot of discussions about how we could limit or improve the initiative process, and frankly I think it's just very hard to do because most people are unwilling to really curb that process. Most citizens want that process because they see it as a check on the government that they may not trust. So I've kind of lost hope that you're ever going to do anything significant about the initiative process. I think it's there. I think it's saved by the fact that most of these things don't pass. But I do think it would be easier from a court point of view and not getting into trouble with court restrictions if you focused on what, for example, maybe it should take a supermajority of the supervisors to get something onto the ballot, just as we require a supermajority to put bond measures on the ballot for the legislature. That, I think, is a more feasible thing. I think you're going to get into a lot of trouble when you start putting limits on what the people can do. I think there you'll both run out of popular support and legal support.
Well, let me say, just do the arithmetic. Instead of having 17 state measures on November 8th, some of them could have been on in June. Mm-hmm. And it's easier to digest 8 or 9 than it is 17.
And it sounds like that ship may have sailed at least at the state level then.
And the optics are very poor because you're trying to limit people's participation in the democratic system, and you're trying to make it harder to get things on the ballot, which is a hard thing to explain, even if you feel like it's for the greater good. In San Francisco, I believe in 2011, I believe it was Prop E, it was a Scott Wiener idea, that would allow the Board of Supervisors and the mayor to alter the post facto, and it was very easily defeated, even though the people who were running against it raised a fraction of the money, because it's very easy to say you think you're the smartest guy in the room, you're going to overturn a democratically elected election, essentially, and it was, and I believe 67% of the people voted against it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, once you give sovereignty, it's hard to take it away. Let's go back to the phone lines here to Andrea from San Francisco. Andrea, welcome to City Visions. What's your question tonight?
Thank you. It's more of a comment. I am from Argentina, and I'm a citizen of the U.S., and I have two small children. I love the direct democracy, and I think that we all have to make a point to be even more involved. So we make it a family event to study how the ballot gets there and what the measures are. And we certainly do not have the time to go through all of them, but we have resources that can educate us and teach us. And I definitely think there are too many at once this time, having been broken down in May or June, whenever it is, or in November will be much easier. But I think that it's like, you know, it's like you trust your doctor that you chose, but you're never going to trust your doctor blindly. So you have to do your research. You have to get involved. And I feel that we all have to be more involved to educate our children for the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great comment. I appreciate you calling in. And actually, the fact that you're from Argentina reminds me that, you know, we probably have a lot we can learn from other countries. And Professor Kane, have you looked at other states or countries that utilize direct democracy perhaps more effectively than we do? And are there lessons that we could learn from those other jurisdictions?
Well, the only other country that really comes close to California is Switzerland, which, by the way, was the first country to really adopt the modern form of direct democracy in the 13th century. But most of the European nations have a national referendum system, so there'll be a referendum about the EU, or a referendum about Brexit, or you know, about whether to break up Great Britain. But there isn't really the initiative process per se. So, you know, again, I think we're an outlier in the state of California. When you talk about this back east, you explain this to people in Connecticut or even in Massachusetts, they don't have the same user-friendly system. They don't have as many of these measures as we have in the West. And so when I explain that we actually worry about whether we have too much democracy, whether it exceeds the citizen capacity, they think, what? Really? I've never heard of too much democracy before.
So, Joe Eskenazi, on this point, do you have other
I talked to a Swiss political scientist for the story in San Francisco Magazine, and he was amazed that there would be 25 items on the ballot. He said that they would never vote on more than four or five at a time. However, Swiss people vote frequently throughout the year. They might vote, you know, three, four, five times in a year. So it's a different way of doing things.
June and November.
Yeah. I can tell you also, in my household, I married a French person, and French elections are very simple. You put an X next to the person's name, and you drop it into the box, and it's all done by hand. So when they look at California with the complicated ballot that's like a Scantron test, well, in France, they don't take Scantron tests. It's completely alien to her. Mm-hmm. And so when I have tagged along when she goes to vote at the French in the French elections, and it's, you know, you put your X next to the name and you put it in the box and you're done. Mm-hmm. It's completely different.
When I was growing up in Europe, it was called a plebiscite, mm-hmm. because a referendum is not an initiative. It is a repeal of a law enacted by the legislature. And that leads to a further complication, because your vote is yes or no.
It's very confusing. There's one of those on the ballot this year.
And that is confusing. Mm-hmm. And
very confusing.
The requirements for qualifying a referendum for the ballot are higher in terms of signatures than they are for an initiative.
It is more comforting, though, with a referendum. A referendum is essentially the people's check on our lawmakers, saying, do you believe this was a good idea, this law they passed, as opposed to citizens writing the law and enacting the law, but, you know, oh, but we're not going to pay for it, yeah. That kind of thing, yeah.
Well, let me bring Professor Kane back into this. I mean, we certainly talked about the benefits of having mm-hmm. direct democracy. It's a check, et cetera. Are there losers in this process? I mean, are there certain groups, you know, I would think minority groups in the truest sense of the word, not just, you know, religious or ethnic or racial minorities, but just those in the minority of this particular vote? Are there people who tend to suffer because of direct democracy more than others?
I would say, yeah. I would say groups that don't have a lot of money these days, given what we were talking about earlier, the professionalization of the process, mm-hmm. I think you don't see many measures that are coming out of East L.A. or the barrios of San Jose, et cetera. Most of the measures are coming out of either you know, interest groups or wealthier neighborhoods. And so we've had measures that are conservative and liberal, so I wouldn't say that it skews particularly in one ideological direction, but I think taxpayer groups have tended to be more powerful than other kinds of groups. The measures tend not to be about redistributive causes, although you can find a few examples here and there. So I think it does tend to skew in a direction that is a little more skeptical of spending, but that's not true in San Francisco. That's true for the rest of the state. San Francisco, of course, is a much more liberal area. So, I want to go back to one point, though, that's really, I think, worries a lot of political scientists, and that is that what people know about these measures is really not a lot. And somebody was talking about, the Argentinian lady was talking about how it's a way to educate people. And yeah, for some people it is an educated moment, but for a lot of people it isn't. It's just a nuisance. And so when the PPIC does polling on what people know about the state budget, for example, you find out that they have no idea that K-12 education is the number one item. They have no idea of, and I'm sure this is true at the local government level, what the consequences are of giving higher pensions to a group or.
So voter education is obviously going to be critical to this, and we only got a couple minutes left. So let me let Joe Eskenazi weigh in quickly on this question of who might lose with this process.
Well, statewide, where reading through the ballot just this year, statewide ballot measures are I find them to be much more confusing than the local ones, and of course the ramifications are much larger. And throughout the decades, racial and other minorities in California have been scapegoated and victimized. By 1920, only within 6-7 years of the introduction of direct democracy in California, we passed the Alien Lands Act, which restricted Asiatics, as they were called at the time. Mm-hmm. In the 1950s and 60s, you had housing laws that were essentially disenfranchising black people. Later on in the 80s and 90s, you have laws aimed at Latinos. And then in the 2000s, you are taking marriage rights away from LGBT people. So this is a problem. This is something that, certainly that's not the legacy of direct democracy, but certainly minorities have been victimized throughout the decades.
And Judge Kopp, final word, I want to hear from you about your wish list for how to reform.
When you look at the whole scene, and when I look back over 50, 60 years, I grew up till I was 21 in New York State and had no such thing as an initiative. It's not a people's activity now. And that, of course, is regrettable, but it could be controlled if there's a demand and if legislators get a little steel in their spine, and I suppose locally too. We've talked about methods of reducing the number. And I'll tell you, I'm a voter now. Just a voter, let's say. I'm not a supervisor, a senator, or a judge. And it is work going through that voter information pamphlet.
Well, we wish all of you good luck with your choices this November. That's City Visions for this evening. My guests have been Bruce Kane, professor of political science and director of Stanford University's Bill Lane Center for the American West, Joe Eskenazi, senior editor at San Francisco Magazine, and Judge Quentin Kopp, retired former San Francisco supervisor and prior California state senator. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions pages on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Please join us next week for a discussion of high-speed rail with High Speed Rail Authority Chairman Dan Richard. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great week.